A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
You know, Korn, this whole show runs on GPU compute, and we wouldn't be here without Modal.
Seriously. And that's what powers all our text-to-speech. Everything you're hearing right now.
They're an AI infrastructure platform. Developers use them to run GPU workloads in the cloud with zero infrastructure headache.
If you're building anything with AI, check them out. Modal.com. Daniel sent us this one, and it's a topic that sits right at the intersection of archaeology, theology, and some of the most contested real estate on Earth. He's asking about the history of Jewish presence in Hebron, and specifically about the Cave of the Patriarchs, including what's apparently lurking underneath it. The history stretches back thousands of years, the politics are very much alive today, and there's a genuine mystery built into the bedrock.
I mean, where do you even plant your flag on a city that has been continuously inhabited for over 3,000 years? That's not a metaphor. Archaeologists put continuous settlement there well into the Bronze Age, and it just never stopped. People kept living there through every empire that rolled through the region.
Which is either a testament to the location, or a failure of imagination on the part of every conqueror who decided it was worth keeping.
But what makes Hebron singular, even among ancient cities, is that it's not just old in a geological sense. It's old in a way that three of the world's major religious traditions treat as foundational. Jews, Christians, Muslims, all of them have a claim staked in that ground, and the claim isn't abstract, it's a specific cave. The Cave of the Patriarchs, what Jewish tradition calls Machpelah, the believed burial site of Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebekah, Jacob and Leah.
When you say believed, you mean that in the religious sense, not the archaeological hedging sense.
The tradition is ancient and consistent. The Genesis account names the specific location. Abraham purchases the cave from a Hittite named Ephron, specifically to bury Sarah. That transaction is described in more legal detail than almost anything else in the early biblical narrative, which tells you something about how significant the ownership question was even then.
A real estate dispute encoded in scripture. Some things don't change.
Then it becomes the burial site for the patriarchs and matriarchs across subsequent generations. So you have this site that is, by the account of the text, intentionally purchased, intentionally established as a family burial ground, and that tradition has been maintained in one form or another ever since.
What I find interesting about that transaction is how specific the text is. It's not just Abraham buried Sarah there. There's a negotiation. There's a named seller, a named price, witnesses, a formal handover. It reads almost like a legal deposition.
That's exactly what scholars have pointed out. The level of contractual specificity in Genesis 23 is unusual even by ancient Near Eastern standards. Some biblical historians have argued that the detail was preserved precisely because the ownership question was contested even in antiquity, and the tradition needed to be airtight. You're not just recording a burial, you're recording the title deed.
Which means the argument about who owns that ground is literally as old as the text itself.
The text is doing the work of a land registry. That's a remarkable thing to say about a passage most people read as a grief story, which it also is. Abraham has just lost his wife. The whole transaction is happening in the middle of mourning, and yet the legal scaffolding is meticulous.
By the way, Claude Sonnet 4.6 is writing our script today. Just flagging it.
Our friendly AI down the road. Okay, so the Cave of the Patriarchs. What makes it such a powder keg, historically and right now?
That's what we're going to get into, because the site has never been just a religious monument. It's been a political instrument, a military objective, a symbol of continuity, and a flashpoint, sometimes all at once. And there's apparently something underneath it that nobody has fully mapped.
That part genuinely keeps me up at night, in the best possible way.
High praise from a former pediatrician turned DJ.
The two careers have more in common than you'd think. The thing about Hebron that I want to establish before we go deep is that it is not a place where history happened and then stopped. Every layer is still active. The biblical period, the Ottoman period, 1929-1967, the Hebron Protocol of 1997. These aren't chapters in a closed book. They're all operating simultaneously in that city right now.
Which is exactly why Daniel's prompt is so well-timed, and exactly why we need to take this carefully and in order. Let's start at the beginning, Hebron.
It's a city that shows up in the biblical narrative almost immediately after the patriarchal stories get moving. Hebron isn't a footnote. It's where Abraham settles after separating from Lot. It's where he's living when the covenant is renewed. It's where he negotiates that land purchase.
The purchase matters because it's the only piece of land Abraham actually owns in Canaan. Everything else is promise. Machpelah is deed.
That distinction is doing enormous theological and legal work that people still argue about today. But the significance of Hebron runs across traditions in ways that don't always get acknowledged. For Christians, the patriarchal lineage is foundational to understanding the Abrahamic covenant that runs through into the New Testament. For Muslims, Ibrahim, Ishaq, and Jacob are prophets, not just ancestors, and Hebron, which they call Al-Khalil, meaning the friend, referring to Abraham as the friend of God, is one of the holiest cities in Islam. Al-Khalil al-Rahman.
All three traditions are essentially pointing at the same plot of land and saying, this is where it started.
The extraordinary thing is that the site itself, the physical structure over the cave, is ancient enough to predate Islam by centuries. The enclosure you walk into today was built by Herod the Great, probably in the 1st century BCE. It's one of the best-preserved Herodian structures anywhere. The walls are massive. Some of the stones are over 7 meters long.
Herod had a type.
He really did. Monumental limestone everywhere. And it's worth pausing on just how extraordinary the construction is, because people sometimes assume the building is medieval or Ottoman, given how intact it looks. But those walls are Herodian. The same period as the Western Wall in Jerusalem, the same engineering sensibility, the same obsessive scale. Herod was building for permanence in a way that very few rulers in any era actually achieved.
There's something almost paradoxical about that. A king notorious in Jewish tradition for the massacre of the innocents ends up being the person who physically enshrines the most sacred Jewish burial site.
History has a dark sense of humor. But the point is, the physical continuity of that site is real. It's not a later invention. You have a structure that's over 2,000 years old sitting on top of a cave that the tradition says has been a burial site since the 2nd millennium BCE.
Which is a lot of layers to excavate, literally and otherwise.
The excavating is almost entirely metaphorical, because nobody has been allowed to physically excavate there in modern times. But let's get into how the Jewish community in Hebron actually evolved across those layers. Because the story from biblical period to the present is not a straight line.
It's more of a line that keeps getting cut and then somehow rejoins itself.
After the biblical period, after David rules from Hebron for 7 years before capturing Jerusalem, the city remains significant, but it shifts. Different empires, different administrators. The Jewish community persists, but under varying degrees of restriction and tolerance. What's interesting about the medieval and Ottoman periods is that Jewish presence in Hebron was never zero. There's this narrative that gets applied to Israel generally, the idea that Jewish communities only returned in the 20th century. Kalm did a thorough piece on this, tracing the communities that simply never left the land, and Hebron is one of the clearest examples.
Never left, but also never had full access.
Right, and the Ottoman period is where that gets most concrete. Jews were prohibited from entering the cave of the patriarchs itself, completely barred from going inside. What they were permitted to do was climb to the 7th step of a staircase on the exterior of the Herodian enclosure. That was it, the 7th step. You could touch the wall of the structure, you could pray at that point, and then you had to stop.
The 7th step. That's not a restriction. That's an insult dressed up as a concession.
It held for centuries, and the community accepted it, because what was the alternative? You had a Jewish community in Hebron that was paying significant taxes, navigating discriminatory legal structures, surviving earthquakes, surviving periods of instability, and they maintained themselves there because the connection to that site was worth it. The Cave of the Patriarchs wasn't incidental to why Jews lived in Hebron. It was the reason.
How large was the community during the Ottoman period? and trying to get a sense of what we're actually talking about. Are we talking about dozens of families or something more substantial?
It fluctuated considerably. At various points in the 16th and 17th centuries, you had a few hundred Jewish residents, sometimes more. There were periods of growth when waves of Sephardic Jews arrived after the expulsion from Spain in 1492, and Hebron absorbed some of them. There were also periods of severe contraction after earthquakes, or after particularly harsh tax regimes made life unsustainable. But the floor never hit zero. Even in the worst periods, there was a nucleus of families who stayed.
They were supported by diaspora communities, weren't they? There was some kind of fundraising network.
The Chalukah system. Essentially, a charitable distribution network that funneled money from Jewish communities in Europe and elsewhere to support the communities in the four holy cities of the land of Israel, Jerusalem, Hebron, Safed, and Tiberias. It was an organized, sustained effort to keep those communities alive, specifically because of their religious significance. So the Ottoman-era community in Hebron wasn't just surviving on its own resources. It was being deliberately maintained by Jews who weren't there, because they understood that presence at that site mattered.
Which makes what happened in 1929 even more devastating in a specific way. Because the community that was attacked wasn't a new arrival. These were families with roots going back generations.
Some of them going back centuries. The 1929 massacre is one of those events that I think doesn't get the weight it deserves in how people understand the modern conflict. Arab rioters killed 67 Jews in Hebron over 2 days in August. The British response was to evacuate the surviving Jewish population entirely. So the community that had maintained itself through Ottoman restrictions, through earthquakes, through every difficulty, was effectively ended not by the massacre alone, but by the British decision that followed it.
The massacre did the killing. The evacuation did the erasure.
It held for nearly 40 years. There was no continuous Jewish presence in Hebron from 1929 until after the Six-Day War in 1967. When Israel took control of the West Bank, Hebron came under Israeli administration, and within a year you had the first attempt at resettlement. April 4, 1968. Moshe Levinger and a group of others checked into the Park Hotel in Hebron, ostensibly for Passover, and then declined to leave.
As one does.
It was a deliberate act, and it worked. The Israeli government eventually accommodated them, and the settlement of Kiryat Arba was established adjacent to an Israeli Defense Forces base just outside the city. That's the Center for Israel Education's account of how the modern Jewish presence in Hebron got its footing again.
It's never been straightforward since. The community that exists in Hebron today is small, somewhere around 1,000 residents in the Israeli-controlled zone, which is called H2 under the 1997 Hebron Protocol. Meanwhile, the Palestinian Authority governs H1, which is about 80% of the city, with roughly 200,000 people.
The disproportion is stark. 1,000 people in 20% of the city, 200,000 in 80%. And that division is a direct product of the Oslo-era negotiations, specifically the Hebron Protocol, which tried to create a workable division of a city that is functionally indivisible at the level of its history.
How did the protocol actually work in practice? Because drawing a line on a map is one thing, but you still have a city where people need to move around, where commerce happens, where there are shared roads.
It's been a grinding practical failure in many respects, even if it was a genuine diplomatic achievement in the abstract. The division created a patchwork of checkpoints and restricted zones that made ordinary life extremely difficult for Palestinian residents in and around H2. Certain streets became effectively inaccessible. The old market area, the Kasbah, which had been a commercial center, declined sharply because the movement restrictions made normal trade almost impossible. At the same time, the Israeli community in H2 required significant military protection, which shaped the character of the entire zone. It's one of the most heavily militarized small urban areas on Earth relative to its civilian population.
You can divide a map. You cannot divide 3,000 years of layered meaning.
That's the problem in one sentence, and it feeds directly into why the Cave of the Patriarchs itself remains so contested, because the site sits in H2, under Israeli administration, but it is a holy site for Muslims as well. The Ibrahim Mosque occupies part of the same structure. So you have a single Herodian building that functions simultaneously as a Jewish shrine and an Islamic mosque, divided by a partition, with separate entrances and a history of violence attached to it.
Including 1994, which we should probably come back to when we get into the modern tensions. But the thread I want to pull on first is what's actually underneath all of this. Literally, because the surface history is complicated enough, what's below it is a different kind of mystery.
That mystery starts with the underground cavern. This is where it gets strange. The structure above it, the Herodian enclosure, is well documented. We know its dimensions, we know the construction period, we've studied the masonry extensively. What's below it is almost entirely inference.
Which is remarkable given how much attention this site has received over the centuries.
The cave itself has never been fully explored in modern times. There was one documented entry in recent history, and it was not by archaeologists. In 1981, a group of Israeli officials and researchers lowered a small child, I believe it was the daughter of one of the officials, through a narrow opening to see what was inside. The child reported a chamber, some bones, some artifacts. That's essentially the extent of the direct modern observation.
A child's testimony is the primary archaeological record for one of the holiest sites on Earth.
It's not how you design a research program, no. But it tells you something about how constrained the access has been. The site is too sensitive, politically and religiously, for any systematic excavation to be permitted.
I think it's worth sitting with how strange that is for a moment. We have ground-penetrating radar. We have LIDAR. We have non-invasive imaging technologies that have mapped burial chambers in Egypt without moving a single stone. And yet the Cave of Machpelah, which sits at the center of one of the most consequential territorial disputes on Earth, has essentially never been examined with any of those tools in a systematic way.
The technology isn't the constraint. The politics are the constraint. Any proposal to conduct even non-invasive imaging of the site immediately raises questions about who authorized it, who controls the findings, who gets to publish them, and what the implications are if the results confirm or complicate any particular narrative. Those questions are unanswerable in the current political environment, so the surveys don't happen.
Then there's the 2015 tunnel discovery, which complicated the picture further.
Israeli archaeologists identified what appeared to be ancient tunnel systems beneath the site. The interpretation of those tunnels is contested. Some researchers think they're connected to the Herodian construction, service passages, or drainage systems. Others think they predate Herod entirely and could be related to earlier use of the site going back into the Second Temple period or even earlier. The problem is that confirming any of those interpretations would require access that nobody is going to grant.
Because granting access means one side or another is implicitly conceding something about ownership or significance.
Every archaeological decision at that site is also a political decision. You can't separate them. Which brings in the 2010 UNESCO controversy, because that's where the political dimension became completely explicit. UNESCO designated the Cave of the Patriarchs as a Palestinian World Heritage Site, which immediately drew fierce objection from Israel and from Jewish communities internationally.
The designation essentially treated the site as if the Jewish connection to it were incidental or secondary.
That's the core objection. The Herodian structure was built by a Jewish king over a site that Jewish tradition had revered for well over a millennium by that point. The claim that this is primarily a Palestinian heritage site rather than a shared or specifically Jewish site requires a reading of history that the archaeological and textual record doesn't support. Israel formally withdrew from UNESCO in 2019 over a pattern of decisions like this one. The United States had already withdrawn in 2018.
Which was the right call. You don't get to launder political objectives through heritage designations.
The deeper issue is that the UNESCO framing, whatever its intent, affects how the site is perceived internationally. It shapes funding, it shapes access negotiations, it shapes the vocabulary that journalists and diplomats use when they talk about Hebron. And once that vocabulary shifts, it's very hard to shift it back.
Language does the work that armies can't always do.
Hebron is a place where that is demonstrably true. The 1994 event you flagged is part of this. Baruch Goldstein, an Israeli-American settler, opened fire inside the Ibrahim Mosque portion of the Cave of the Patriarchs during Ramadan prayers. 29 people were killed. The Israeli government condemned it, Goldstein was killed at the scene, and the fallout was severe. It accelerated the Oslo negotiations in some ways, but it also hardened positions on both sides in ways that are still visible in the city today.
It handed ammunition to everyone who wanted to argue that Jewish presence in Hebron is inherently violent, which flattens a much more complicated history.
One atrocity doesn't define 3,000 years, but it does define the news cycle and often the policy cycle after that. And the specific timing matters too. This happened during Ramadan, inside the mosque section, during morning prayers. The maximum possible desecration of a sacred space at the most sacred time of the Muslim calendar. Whether or not that was calculated, the symbolic weight of it was enormous, and it resonated far beyond Hebron. It became a reference point in how Palestinian communities understood the entire settlement enterprise, not just in Hebron, but across the West Bank.
The Israeli government's response, condemning it while not fundamentally changing the structure of Jewish presence in Hebron, meant that the condemnation could only go so far in changing that perception.
What you're left with in Hebron today is a city where the archaeological case for Jewish continuity is strong, where the physical evidence of that continuity is literally built into the landscape, and where the political framework makes it almost impossible to examine that evidence without it becoming a provocation.
The mystery underneath the cave and the mystery of how to govern the city above it are basically the same problem. Nobody can look too closely without it meaning something they're not prepared to mean, and that's exactly why this isn't just a theoretical issue. It has real implications for how you read the news, how you evaluate policy arguments, how you understand what's actually at stake when someone says Hebron in a geopolitical context. So what do listeners actually do with all of this? Because it's not abstract history.
The first thing I'd say is, resist the framing that Hebron's history begins in 1967. That's the frame that a lot of coverage implicitly uses, treating the modern Jewish presence as a settler project that appeared from nowhere. But we've walked through what that erases. The community that was massacred in 1929 wasn't a colonial implant. The Cave of the Patriarchs wasn't built by the Israeli government. When you start the clock in 1967, you've already conceded the argument before the argument starts.
The archaeological record doesn't let you start it there. The Herodian construction alone takes you back over 2,000 years. The textual record goes back further. If you're trying to understand who has a legitimate claim to presence in that city, you need the whole timeline, not a convenient excerpt.
The second thing, and this is where the underground cavern becomes relevant beyond its intrinsic interest, is that what hasn't been excavated matters. The absence of full archaeological access to the cave beneath Machpelah is itself a political fact. Every year that goes by without a proper survey is a year that certain interpretations remain unchallenged by evidence. That cuts both ways, but it cuts most sharply against the party with the stronger textual and historical case, which is the Jewish one.
Unanswered questions tend to get filled in by whoever tells the most compelling story loudest.
Which is why the 2010 UNESCO designation was so damaging. It didn't need to be archaeologically accurate to be politically effective. And understanding that mechanism, how heritage frameworks can be weaponized ahead of the evidence, is useful for anyone trying to follow how these disputes evolve.
Know who's writing the label before you read what it says.
Which is why paying attention to who controls the narrative around sites like this matters as much as paying attention to the sites themselves. The cave underneath Machpelah is a perfect emblem of that. We don't know what's down there. The 1981 observation gives us fragments. The 2015 tunnel work gives us more questions than answers. And the political reality makes it unlikely anyone is going to get proper access anytime soon.
That unresolved quality is going to keep driving the argument. Every claim made in the absence of evidence is essentially a bet that the evidence will never arrive to contradict it.
There's a comparison that I keep coming back to, which is the situation at the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. You have a similarly contested site, similarly restricted access for archaeological work, and a similarly frozen evidentiary situation where the absence of excavation allows competing narratives to coexist without ever being tested. The difference is that the Temple Mount dispute is better known internationally. Hebron operates in its shadow, which means the dynamics there get less scrutiny even though the underlying structure of the problem is almost identical.
Two sides, same mechanism. The unexcavated ground does political work that no amount of negotiation can resolve.
What I'll be watching is whether any of the political frameworks shift enough to allow serious archaeological work. The Abraham Accords opened up regional relationships in ways nobody predicted. Whether that kind of normalization eventually creates space for neutral, internationally supervised excavation at a site like Machpelah, I don't know. But it's not impossible in the way it would have seemed 10 years ago.
I'd also watch the UNESCO question, whether the organization develops any appetite to revisit designations that were made on political rather than archaeological grounds. I'm not holding my breath, but the pressure exists.
The cave isn't going anywhere. Whatever is down there has waited this long.
That's either reassuring or unsettling, depending on your disposition. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtoff, for keeping this whole operation running. Modal is handling our infrastructure as always, and we're grateful for it. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you've been listening for a while and haven't left us a review, now is a good moment to do that. It helps more than you'd think.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by Claude Sonnet 4.6, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.